All right. Hi, everyone. Welcome to a new and very, very exciting episode of the EITF project. We have Richard Salzman with us today. I hope I pronounced your last name right, Richard. And we are very excited for this one because Richard is the first person that we're interviewing from the academia industry, but he kind of wears three hats in his everyday life. And it's going to be great to explore all the different aspects of his career and how he transitions from one to another during the course of every day. So welcome to the show, Richard.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. So I'm going to start with the first question that I usually ask all of our experts, right? We start with this question because we think it's very important to reflect back on our first jobs. So what was your first job? And what was your, what is one important lesson that you learned from your first job that you carry with you till today?
Well, if I begin with my first job in after college, is that fair enough? I don't want to
start with
I don't want to start with the early ones, like working in lumber yards and things like that. But my first job was in New York City in 1981 with a bank. So the bank is ultimately, you know, now part of J.P. Morgan, but at the time, and the older ones in the audience might remember, it was called Manufacturers Hanover Trust. So I began in a management training program, which was nice. So they took in about 30. Newly minted BAs from nice universities and colleges around the country. And their idea was to train us as if we were in business school. So we really didn't have any customer contact for that first year. It was as if we were at business school and we had business school professors coming in. We had bankers coming in doing sessions all summer long. And the management training program was supposed to be grooming us for ultimately a long career in the bank and management positions. So what did I learn from that? First of all, discipline and a wide open mind. I think the things they taught us, from the minutiae of accounting to the broad-based strategies of the bank and histories of banking and where banking stood at that point, I realized, and I did get trained for this somewhat in college, the ability to not only know the details of your profession, the real nitty-gritty details of your profession, but also the broader context in which you're operating. So I noticed over the years that people mostly knew the details, had perfectly fine careers, but couldn't really branch out much or become managers. And those who were overly conceptual, overly abstract, without a knowledge of details, didn't perform as well either. So I think if I were to give a quick answer, what I learned was the importance of knowing the details as well as the big picture. Not easy to do. When I was in the bank, I also got a further degree and I got an MBA, which is a master's in business administration, but which is really also gears you for management. But one thing I also learned was that I really did not have an interest in managing people.
Right.
Certainly not a huge group of people. And I knew, especially at the big banks, any big company, I knew that if I stayed longer, success would depend on not only being a manager, but being a manager of more and more people and more divisions. That's another part of the story we can talk about. But that's an important thing for people to realize, that whether they're engineers or bankers or in the medical field, academia, you do have to judge at some point whether you're going to go the track of managing people versus staying somewhat close to the analytic work, if you will.
And also, like, to your point, understanding what you don't like, I think that is an important thing.
It's interesting that you mentioned MBA, because these days I feel like MBA is a shortcut for people who like want to transition into a different area or who just are looking for something to add on to their resume. And I was wondering how you feel about that and what you think makes for a good MBA candidate. Who actually needs an MBA and who doesn't?
Well, that's a good question. I think you have to have some business experience before you get the MBA. I don't think it's for someone to go right from BA to MBA. I know that is done sometimes. At the other extreme, there are cases where CEOs or people in the executive suite, after many, many years, will go back and get something called the executive MBA. I think the executive MBA is actually something advisable than the MBA coming right out of the BA. So I got the master's in business administration while I was at the bank. The other advantage of that is if you're not independently wealthy, you get the bank to pay for the degree. So the combination of getting the master's in business administration while you're in a business, plus the opportunity for the bank to pay for it. Now, sometimes you might have to strike a deal. You oblige yourself to stay with the bank for a certain number of years afterwards so they get their investment back. But that's the bottom line answer to your question there. I would say an MBA without any direct business experience, I don't think is very advisable. I don't mean to say that the MBA programs are detached from reality, but it's very nice to have that check on what you're learning in classrooms and in the textbooks, a check on how you're actually observing how things are going in your company. The other thing I'd recommend is the MBA is not really good for small businesses, I don't think. I think the MBAs for most schools are really geared toward those who are going to have a career in large corporations. And to the extent you don't think that's for you, the MBA wouldn't be worthwhile. I actually went through a transition of being in very, very big banks to my next part of my career was in a small mid-sized company and then ultimately starting my own firm. So I went from big to middle to small. And, partly because of my interests, but looking back on what I learned in the MBA, it was most applicable to the big banks that I was with and less so after
right. that. You know, I think your transition of going from the big to the middle to the small is these days becoming very, very popular because that's products are gaining a lot of popularity in today's. But, you know, with everything that you just mentioned, right, when I was thinking about this interview, you have three different hats that you wear throughout the day, right? You have a career in business, you have a career as an entrepreneur, and you also have a career in academia.
Right.
For all of our audience members, you know, who have had a successful career and who want to give back and teach the next generation to follow in their footsteps, what do you think is one common trait that you need to possess to be successful in these three different fields, at least for the ones that you've chosen?
Well, I think it goes back to my original answer, my first answer, which was you're likely to be good at that if even in the details of what you're doing in your business career, that you are aware of the bigger picture. Now, the bigger picture could mean simply beyond your company to the industry you're in, but it could also be the industry you're in and then relative to the broader economy. Or sometimes people will say, well, I'm familiar with the US-based sector, but I want to learn more about and be aware of the global sector I'm in. That's part of it. And also a kind of studiousness that is required to be in academia. Business people, this is hard to make it general, but business people tend not to be theoretical, and they're not necessarily teachers. And you can find cases where there's training. There are people, as you know, in businesses that it's part of HR, part of training generally, where they'll educate and mentor and train other people in the company. If you like doing that kind of thing, that's a indication that you might be good in academia. And academia is a completely different, well, I wouldn't say completely different. It's so different from business. You also have to prepare in terms of saying, what do I really want to teach in academia? And then back into it and say, well, what kind of degrees are necessary to be able to teach that? And I wouldn't start with, let me go get a PhD and then see who wants it. I would start with, I suppose you want to just teach. You start with what places nearby me where I want to live need IT teachers. And then maybe you don't need a PhD. Maybe you only need a certificate in something. Oftentimes, they call them professor of the practice. Take advantage of this. Universities will hire people who've had lengthy business experience, and they call them professors of the practice, meaning you don't have to get a PhD, but you do have to demonstrate that you've had this, you know, fairly long and upward moving career in some area. Now there, you would probably teach at a business school or at a vocational school or something like that. You wouldn't be teaching in the economics department, say, of a major university, because your skills and your knowledge and your experience are specific. Universities do, colleges, trade schools do look for that kind of expertise, and it's the expertise plus the ability to teach it and convey it and do all the administrative things like putting together a syllabus and pulling together reading materials and meeting with students and all the kind of administrative things that go with being in academia. So I'll leave it at that. I could tell you more about how I made that transition myself, but that's the kind of thing I would look for. By the way, you mentioned something about giving back. I think it's actually not a good motive. That might sound odd, but I think the dedication and the work required to move from business to academia, or indeed do both. So suppose you're not entirely comfortable leaving your long-term business track record and moving into academia. That's what I did. I kept part one foot in business as I took another step into academia, because I wasn't entirely confident that I could do academia exclusively. And it wasn't just the confidence in myself. It was confidence in whether I could get people to hire me and stay with me for a long time. That kind of, but the motivation, what I'm talking about is the motivation, I think, really should be very self-interested, because there's a lot of work involved. There's a lot of dedication. There's a lot of time management that's required. And you have to really love what you're doing and not feel like you're engaged in philanthropy. Now, if you're someone who's actually motivated by feeling you're being philanthropic, that's another issue, and that's okay. I think that's okay. But I myself, I didn't go into academia feeling, well, I've been very greedy in banking all these years, and I made a lot of money, and I feel kind of guilty, so I think I should go teach young students. It wasn't that at all. It was much larger. Very proud of my business career, but it was much more, you know, now I'm really, really interested in this other thing. And the business stuff was kind of becoming boring to me and routine. And so the motivation was strong to move into this other area. But I don't think this is really any different than those who go through career changes in business. You know, academia is different, but we've all known of people, or maybe ourselves, who are in a particular industry and want to move to another industry. You have to be motivated and passionate about that move, and not doing it out of sense of obligation or guilt, I would say, I think.
I think it's great that you spoke about this, that, you know, you need to have the passion for teaching, and you need to like it, right? Another important thing that you said in your answer was that you didn't walk away from business. You had a foot in business. I think it helps to realize that you still want to keep doing this. But I think it also helps in your academia career, because you're always updated with the latest stuff
that's
going on in business. So you can bring that into your teaching experience as well.
That's absolutely true. And even though my particular case is finance and economics, and I can give you examples of this, but I think it's also true of someone, I'm trying to imagine someone in IT, and they're at a company, say they're at Google or something like that, and they're in IT, but they want to teach at a technical school. If they kept a foot in a business and doing IT, yes, they'd be a much better teacher. Now, a couple things this might interest you. I have noticed of the two areas and this might be unique to what I'm teaching, but in the relationship between academia and business is very interesting, because on the one hand, especially in the social sciences, I know STEM is different. I'm in the social sciences, so this might not relate to STEM, but in the social sciences and academia, there's a distrust of business. There's a feeling that business people are short range, not very interested in big ideas, too interested in money, too materialistic. On the other hand, the same academic attitude is impressed by the practicality of people in the commercial world. They're impressed by people who are able to succeed, make money, build products, build companies. And so there's a kind of love-hate relationship. Now, in business, there's something similar going on. And I notice this because I'm in each field. Yeah. So now in business, there's a distrust of academia on the grounds that academia dislikes us. Academia is anti-capitalist, anti-business, anti-money-making. And so we don't trust academia. And the academics are detached, ivory tower type, detached from reality, so we don't respect them. See, this is a business. But here's the good part. The business people will say, but I really admire them. They have PhDs. They're really smart. They publish books. They command the attention of a room by teaching. So there's a love-hate relationship also from the business side to the academic side. Now, by straddling the two, I find that when I'm with academic people, if I stress my practical connections and knowledge, it's very helpful. If I'm in business, if I'm in a business setting, then they know I know business.
That's very smart. Yeah.
I stress, you know, we also have this theoretical knowledge. So if you do this, for those of you listening, be aware of that if you're not already, and you can use it to your advantage to some degree in that regard. Anyway, so I'll leave it at that, but I have Yeah, I would say of the three jobs I have, I teach political economy. I've done that now for about 10 years. Political economy is politics and economics, but basically how they interact, which is a big topic these days. And I didn't get my PhD. I did get the PhD. I realized I had to get a PhD. And I got it when I was 47 years old. So that's fairly late. The average PhD candidate at Duke is probably 25 or 26 years old. And many of them came right out of a BA, you know, so they might be a Harvard graduate. And, you know, two or three years later, they're going to a PhD program. I started later and had a 25-year career in business, banking, and finance. So I do that. I have a consulting firm where I do quantitative forecasting of investments, and then I sell the service as a research and forecasting service by subscription basis to institutional investors. So I give them reports on the business cycle, stocks and bonds and currencies and things like that. I started doing that with that mid-sized firm that I told you about in 1993. So I've been doing that for actually 30 years. And the academic part I folded in basically in the last 10 years. Now, in academia, what's called a full load of teaching is four courses every semester. You know, there's two semesters, fall and spring, and a full load, basically what amounts to a full-time job, would be four courses. And I struck a deal where I only teach two per semester. So I do that because I have the investment consulting, and I knew that I could not do both, and I wanted to do both. I wanted to retain the income that I was getting from the investment consulting and then fold in the income from teaching. And I still do teaching and researching on the other side, but I would say half my time, at least half my time, is spent on academic things, teaching, researching, speaking, and, you know, roughly the other half on investment consulting. And because the investment consulting, as I just described it to you, since it's pretty much economics and following the markets and following government policy, when I go to campus, those are exactly the kind of things I'm teaching. I mean, I'm not teaching students how to invest, but I'm teaching them the broad-based picture of how the economy works, how government policy works, the ideas behind it. It's not like I'm stepping into two completely different universes of teaching, you know, completely different material. I look for overlaps. Bitcoin is an example. I have investors who will ask me, should they invest in Bitcoin? Well, when I do the Bitcoin research and figure out what Bitcoin is and how it's different from other investments, I realize, well, set universities are super intrigued by Bitcoin also. So the knowledge I gained by doing the investment research, I can use in class by telling students about Bitcoin. But now the broader picture is, how does Bitcoin fit in central bank digital currencies, or central banking broadly, or public finance broadly? Public finance is, you know, government taxation and government debt and government borrowing and things like that, which I specialize in. So if you can look for overlaps, it's a way to be productive in your research. You're researching one thing, but you can apply it to two or three different areas.
So just to touch a little more about when you mentioned PhD students and teaching and things like that. So, like, for any PhD students who want to become professors, who want to teach full time, these days, what do you think is the best password that would be? Would it be to just like continue researching, or would it be advisable to maybe dip a toe into like the job market, to the business side that academia is so suspicious of? Like, does that help?
It depends on whether it's social sciences or STEM. If you want a career in academia and you're in your early days and you've got your BA already, I still think academia is set up to have this path where you go and get the PhD without much prior work experience. My case was different because I simply decided and chose on an academic career in my late 40s. So it was not a conventional approach. In advising young students today, I would say, no, the approach, what academia is looking for is, you starting out in the PhD program at latest, your mid-20s. And it usually takes, at least in the social sciences, it takes usually 4 to 5 years to get the PhD, but it shouldn't take longer than that. If it takes longer than that, you start developing a reputation for being a perpetual student and maybe too fearful of finishing or unable to finish or unable to write. But if you get to a good school and get to a good program, and again, you have to research that. You have to pick out what you want to be as a professor and then find the school where you get the best PhD to get a job for that. Suppose you finish in 5 years. You have to write a dissertation, usually in social sciences. That alone is a hurdle for some people. There is a phenomenon called ABD, which is all but dissertation. And it's like purgatory. It's like the worst, not the worst thing, but you go through, you know, 4 or 5 years and then you don't do the dissertation. That's a problem. The dissertation is required. The dissertation amounts to a small book or sometimes a big book. And unless you can show at the end of your studies that you can basically write a book. Now, you do get advisory committees helping you. Unless you can do that, you're not going to get the PhD. But if you can do that, the next step is to get it published. Now, you might be surprised, even those who get through a program, write a dissertation, could be, you know, 300 pages or so. I think it's less than half of them get that published. If you can get it published, that puts you in a higher level of accomplishment and achievement so that when you go into the job market to get a professor's job, you're more likely to get it. Now, even when you get the professor's job, there's two tracks. One is tenure, and the other is not tenure track. Now, tenure, if you know, just means that once you get tenure, you have a job for life. Tenure takes about 6 or 7 years. It's almost like, I think it's, I'm told it's equivalent to getting a partnership in a law firm, although it takes less time. Meaning, if you don't get it, you have to like move out. They expect you to get it or they want you to get it. You have to demonstrate that you can get it. And while in that 6 or 7 year period, you're showing, it's kind of like an apprenticeship, I suppose, where you're showing the school, one, you're a good researcher, you're a good teacher, and you're a good colleague. So it's those three things together. And I've seen cases where someone is a very good researcher and maybe even a good teacher, but they're not collegial. I joke about being collegial in college. In college, you have to be collegial. Collegial meaning getting along with people you may disagree with. Getting along with people is not a small thing, but the core of it is that you show that you can do scholarship, that you can do original thinking. Depending on the university, they'll more or less stress whether you can also teach. So at big universities like Duke and elsewhere, they mostly want you to research. And if you can also be a good teacher, they like that. At other places, many of us have gone to get a bachelor's, a BA, in liberal arts colleges and things like that. Those professors mostly teach and don't publish as much. So that's another distinction. Maybe I'm getting too much into the weeds here. And people will have other advice, I think, and other experience when it comes to STEM.
You know, what you said about ABD kind of stuck with me a little bit. A friend of mine who's doing his PhD, he always tells me that you never pick up the phone for a PhD student and ask him when he's defending. Just don't do that.
Right.
But, you know, now that we're talking about education, right, let's dig deep a little bit. What do you think a degree is worth out in the industry when, like, you know, you're an entrepreneur, you interview people to work for you in your company. What do you think a degree is worth when you look at a resume?
Wow, that's a really good question. Being a credentialed person, you think that meaning I have a BA, an MBA, I even have something called a CFA. In finance, a CFA is a chartered financial analyst. That's four, right? That chartered financial analyst is like being a CPA in accounting. But my answer is going to be, I look at a resume, especially in business. I would much more look at the experience of the person than the degrees. And the degrees do signal something. But I think actually the world is moving in this direction where there is less value. It's not less value attached, but in the mix of things that you look at, whereas before credentials, meaning degrees, would be high on the list. I think it's business experience, track record, accomplishments, references from people are becoming much more. Academia, I think, is different. Academia will look for the credentials much more. I think in business, however, business people are increasingly saying, gee, I got this seemingly smart resume and degree, but this person can't do anything. And that could be a problem. Right. There's also, people should be aware also in academia, I think business knows this, there's grade inflation. That's a problem where where the value of grade inflation, meaning professors tend to get higher grades over time for the same amount of work. And that means the quality of the person you're getting, you know, an A student today is not the same as an A student, say, 25 years ago. So I think business does adjust for that, but that phenomenon has occurred as well. So, but a lot of this has to do with what did you major in? You know, like if you come out of Harvard and you've majored in, you know, ancient Asian literature from, you know, ancient times, that's going to be less valuable, say, than an economics degree. So a lot of this really just pertains to how much does the degree and the training pertain to the job being sought.
Right. I read that some top business schools have just dropped grades altogether. I've heard Harvard doesn't do grades anymore. How do you feel about that?
I'm not sure I would go that far. I would hate to just throw them out completely.
Yeah, it is something that you would turn for. So.
In other words, that's grade inflation is a problem, but the solution to it would not be to throw out the grades. It would be to take the grades with a grain of salt, so to speak. But you still do get performance between students, even though the overall inflation is going up over time. By the way, from my side also, it's very interesting because I get students who will ask me to write them recommendation letters.
Right.
And that's very interesting because I wasn't used to doing that. I mean, I would give recommendations when I was in business, but in academia, it's a big part of the job. So in any particular semester, I might get 20 requests. And this is if I'm teaching 120 students or so, maybe 20% of them might ask me for a letter of recommendation. And it could be anywhere from a White House internship to a job on Wall Street to a think tank or law school. Often they'll say to you, write me a letter for law school. And it's interesting because I had to figure out in advance the kind of wording and the kind of adjectives I would use depending on the quality of the student. You know, I didn't want to use the same for every student who asked me.
Yeah.
And in some cases, I would say to a student, I don't know you well enough, and I'm not sure my letter will be strong enough to help you. So you should probably ask somebody else.
Yeah, I think that's good that you do say that to students, because I have had friends who've gone to professors who don't know them very well, and their recommendation letters, they weren't super happy with.
Right.
That you do let them know. Yeah.
And one thing I do ask, interestingly, even for those I know well, if I say yes, I'll say to them, all right, send me three things. Send your resume. Send me your grade transcripts, because I may know them in my class, but I don't know their entire grade transcript. But then I say to them, in the email, give me 500 words, no more, on why you want to do this.
Yeah.
Why you want to go to law school, or why you want to, you know, work at the White House.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting to see the answers and how good they are. You know, it can't be something like, you know, my parents want me to, or I got peer pressure to do it. That's really helpful for me in writing the letters.
I think that's really good in kind of like screening for people who are truly committed. Like from my end, like I know Nandini and I both, we have our master's, and I'm pretty sure that I got into the program that I did because of a very strong recommendation from my internship supervisor.
Right.
So, like, and there were some signs that he was taking this very seriously. Like, he asked me things that were sort of like similar to what you asked your students. Yeah. And that's a sign that, like, you put a lot of like work into your side of the writing the letter, too. So that would be very helpful for their application.
And this relates back to what you were asking earlier, especially if it's a degree. You know, now that I'm done with Duke, I want to go get a law degree or an MBA or something like that. I always say to them, this has to be a means to an end, not just the next thing you do because you don't know what to do next. Are you getting the MBA because this will help you in your business career and get this or that job or be a lawyer? And if I can detect in any way they're only doing it because they're not really sure what to do next and this is the next thing to do, and they probably would be good at it, they probably get a good law degree. I'm reluctant, and I'll advise them not to do that or to do something different. Because it's a lot of money, it's a lot of time.
I think that's important too. Like, you know, I keep joking with Charu and Karthik as well that a lot of us from India are either in engineering or we're doctors. You know, it's kind of the path that you're set on. But like, it's important to think about whether you really like this, whether you want to do this, and why you're doing this. So
yeah.
The fact that you make them think is also important. I do want to ask one more question about the answer that you gave when you said you know, you look at resumes and you look at the experience, right? Having worked in an industry for a long time yourself, right? You mentioned you had a 30-year career. When you look at a resume for someone that you want to hire, would you be more interested in hiring someone who has had multiple different jobs over a specific course of time, or someone that has had one job over a long period of time?
That's a really good question. The first thing I look for is jobs within it, if this makes any sense, jobs within a career. So if it looks like someone has just got one, a job to me is like a rung in a ladder, but a ladder is a career. And some people have no ladder. They have no sense of a ladder in the sense of they're building a career. No career, we all know, you know, bespeaks something like a pattern succession. And it's not that you have to be omniscient. How many students can tell exactly, you know, what their careers will be? But at least if you're thinking in those terms, instead of going from one job to the next, that is one thing I look for. In which case, if you know, I don't know, suppose your career is in finance and you get an entry-level job in banking, but you know that if it turns out the way you want it, this is step one in building your career in finance. So again, this is the balance, I think, between the two, because if you only thought of career abstractly, you know, I want to be a great financier. Okay, that's not enough either. You have to get a particular job. So it's this balance between the right job fitting into a pattern of broader steps of achievement. And if you can get that, I think that's someone I would be more likely to hire, even if they're only going to be at my company for 3 or 4 years. I don't mind that. As long as they deliver value while they're here, you know, I'm not asking them to end their career at my company and only work for me. That would be short-sighted. But it's that combination of practical sense of get the job and get the experience, but connect it to a sequence of jobs you hope to have. If someone is just got sequential jobs and it is not part of the career building process, but rather something where it suggests that they're either bored and they leave after a while, or their incompetence shows up, that's a problem too. So you don't want someone whose serial changes indicate some kind of problem, either with boredom or incompetence.
And now that you answered it that way, like you mentioned that, you know, it's like, you know, rungs of a ladder, because it doesn't matter how many companies you've been to, even if you were in the same company, if you had different roles within the same company, that also counts as, say, a new job, right?
Yes. Yes. That's absolutely true. I'll tell you one thing I learned early in my career. When I was in banking, for about 12 years before I shifted into investments. It was still finance, but there was a shift to leave banking, go into investments and forecasting. I was at three different banks. And when I reflected back on it, I was moving between in 12 years. I was moving between the banks because I thought the boredom I was feeling was because I was at a particular bank. Then I realized the boredom I was feeling was banking. I wish it hadn't taken me three banks to realize that. But sometimes maybe that's what you have to do. Some of that was motivated by just getting higher income, you know, if other banks are bidding for you. But I do remember thinking back, if I'd known more, I would have realized that my dissatisfaction was not with the particular bank I was with, but with the field banking. So that's, I'm sure other people have experienced that. You go from one tech company to another and you realize, I don't really like this subset of tech that I'm in. And that's the problem, not the company. Now, on the other hand, that very first job I got where they had me in a management training program, if you truly are going to become in the future part of the executive suite, part of the senior management of any company, it's a standard procedure for them to put you in different areas. So that's not because you're dissatisfied, but because they just want to give you a wide range of experience as you move your way up. That is a good thing to do if you know what you're doing and that's why you're doing it. But that would be a bigger company. You have to have a bigger company to be, you know, spend some time in marketing, spend some time in finance, and then some time in, you know, some other part of the company. Those require bigger companies. I think generally, by the way, you also should basically decide whether you have an entrepreneurial type spirit, meaning you're open to change, you're easily bored, so you want to try new things and invent new things. And I think the bigger the companies are these days, I certainly experience this, it can be a deadening environment to be in a corporation which is so bureaucratic and so to, you know, unending meetings and things like that and paperwork, that it hurt your spirit, in which case you should shoot for a smaller company, more entrepreneurial company. You don't necessarily have to be the one who starts the company, but you can have an entrepreneurial mindset even within a company that you're the type of person who likes to move and shake things up and be what they call a disruptor today. So that's harder to define. But some people are more comfortable in a bureaucratic setting where they're more of an employee mentality and they're following a routine and they feel more comfortable being told what to do versus an entrepreneurial mindset. You got to make sure you put yourself in the right environment depending on that kind of personality type.
Some of our interviewees who are also entrepreneurs have mentioned having this kind of role as a safety net, and then they can start their own business on the
right
side. Like there are trade-offs to that as well.
Very much. When I went from big to mid-sized company to my own firm, I think if I had not worked at that mid-sized company, by mid-sized I mean there were maybe 12 employees. But when I was at Citibank, there were 30,000 employees. But being at the mid-sized company, I could see how it was put together and I could see how it worked. And that gave me the confidence to start my own company. Not everybody can do that. And I can't say that I'm entirely satisfied with the growth rate of my particular company. But I definitely have much more freedom because I own my own company and set my own terms and hours and things like that and travel. So I have more freedom, but not as much resources as I would have if I stayed in the bigger companies, I suppose. And I certainly would not have been able to add something like academics to what I was.
You know, this interview has been really great, but I have three questions. Let me put it that way. I have three questions, very fun questions before we end the interview. The first question is, we mentioned at the beginning of this interview that you wear three hats during the day. One is a hat in business, one is an entrepreneur, and the other one academia. Which one is your favorite and why?
Oh my gosh. I cannot really rank them that way. I guess I'm leaning toward academia. The way my wife Lisa puts it is she says, if you had to pick one and you can only do one, that'd be one test, right? I think that would be academia, teaching at Duke, teaching in academia. But the other ones are satisfying as well. So maybe that's why I'm doing three of them.
You can't pick between your children.
Right. Yeah, something like that. Good. Thanks for that.
And the second question is, so we've been doing this thing at the end of all of our interviews where we ask our guests to ask the next guest a question, right? Without knowing who they are. The last guest that we had, he had a question for you. So I'll give you a little bit of background. We spoke to David Steinberg. He's a screenwriter for Sappers and all those great shows. So, he was talking about how he feels like he never has job security when it comes to writing for films or being in Hollywood. So his question to you.
The one thing that we don't have in my line of business is career stability. Do you feel like in your career that you have a sense of security that you're going to be able to keep doing it for the rest of your life? Like until you choose to retire, do you feel like you're going to be doing this for the rest of your life if you want to? I mean, you could change careers, but if you want to keep doing this, do you feel like that is something that's within your power to control? Because it's certainly not in our industry. Like I could say, oh, I'd love to keep doing this the rest of my life. It's not up to me.
No, I don't. And when people have asked me that, friends and family have asked me that, and they're surprised actually that I say no, because for example, that my career has been a success, wherever I wanted it to be. So it seems like it's been easy and secure and all that. And even the three jobs I have now, they're all going well and everything. But I have to say that part of the reason that I do three different jobs is to diversify my portfolio of jobs. Now, when you have investments, diversification means, don't put all your eggs in one basket. Don't concentrate in one area. Like the stock market, because the stock market might crash, and then you're stuck, so you should own other things. And I think I have that attitude toward my career. Not only, I think, do I have these three things, because they're all interesting in their separate ways, but I know that I've consciously also done it because if one of them does not work out, I get income from the other two. And the chances of two out of the three not working out are low. But for example, in academia, I knew I would not get tenure. Tenure would be security in academia. I don't have that. I do have multi-year contracts. And I do think they're happy with me and I'm happy with them, but who knows what can go on in academia. Departments change and deans and provosts change. And same thing in business. I have found it very difficult in the forecasting and investment advisory business. It's gone through periods where it has not grown. It's still a decent source of income for me, but I worry about that area of research stagnating. It's not my particular area, but it's just research in general. People don't trust research anymore, which is risky. So there are risks associated with the three things I'm doing. But answer to your question is no, I do not feel secure. But I also think that people who answer no, I think they're more successful. I think, do you agree with this? That because they're constantly saying, I have to do something new and different. I have to be creative. Yeah. I have to keep stirring the pot. I can't expect to sit here and wait until someone taps me on the shoulder and says, you know, this company's going bankrupt and your job doesn't exist anymore. And I think it's so sad when I hear people who they're in a job and it satisfies, but they're not really conscious and aware of the broader picture of what's going on either in their own company or their own industry. And things change so much that you need to be ahead of it. You know, you're ahead of it and managing it rather than reacting to it.
Yeah.
I think that like that points to a mindset of being self-aware and wanting to be like dynamic about,
yes,
you know, just being ready at all times. Like you always have a plan B, C, and D.
Right.
And also like, you know, when you think about it, you're looking for something new doesn't always have to be like, you know, you have to start your own company. Even just networking within your industry, find out what's happening new, just to know about it. I think that itself is a big step forward.
Yes, in all the three things I'm doing, I'm a big advocate of getting out there and going to conferences and going to cocktail parties and talks and things like that. Try to be a thought leader yourself, be on the panel where you're giving your comments about things, and you'll meet people and you'll see opportunities that are just wonderful that you would not see if you just stayed at your desk or stayed at your home. I think the other thing it does is if you have a plan B and C, you're constantly reallocating your time and interest to the one that's returning the most.
Yeah.
So I will take a look at what I'm doing. And if one of them seems to be stagnating a bit and I can't change that, I'll redirect my efforts to the others and try to cultivate them more. So that's another thing anybody can do.
Yeah, interesting. And then the last question, and this question we ask all of our experts as well, so you can go back and look at our interviews. Many people have answered this differently. What is your definition of success?
Happiness, a kind of sustained happiness. You're successful, I think, if you can classify yourself as happy. And now happy is a more enduring thing than just, you know, joy or, you know, some promotion or some new client comes in. The kind of enduring happiness, I think, is the best kind of emotional, psychological sign of things are going well. And we've talked about careers and how to cultivate them, how to change them. But what we haven't talked about, and I think happiness is a big part of this, is how are you balancing all this with friends and romantic partners and recreation and things like that? Because we all know if we work too much and we're not playing enough, so to speak, we're not going to be as happy. So if you need a question to your next guest.
Yep, I was going to ask.
It would be successful as you have been in the commercial realm, and I'm assuming your guests have been, how do they balance and bring in the personal, romantic, friendship, recreation realm? You know, how do they do that? Because I'm constantly dealing with the issue of, am I working too hard and not taking enough time off? But then when I take time off and I'm sitting on a beach, I think, well, this is kind of boring. I'm just sitting on a beach. And what's the point? And then I find myself during, you know, doing hang gliding or something like that. We do something active while we're doing those. So the balance thing interests me as well. I wonder if that comes up a lot.
Okay, that's a good question. We'll definitely ask our next expert, and you can watch that interview as well to see how he answered it.
Yeah, we'll let you know what they say.
Hey, you want one more?
Yeah, sure. Go.
Which I get asked all the time, and my answer is no. Would you ever retire?
That's
okay.
And my answer is, I can't imagine retiring. I don't want to die at my desk of a heart attack. But the idea of stop working and then just go sit on the beach somewhere, I can't imagine it.
That's a great question. That's a really great question.
Because next year I'm going to be 65, so people are asking me, are you going to retire? I said, what? I'm not working at some big company where I have to retire. I'm not in any position right now where I have to retire. Mandatory retirement ages, I don't know if they still exist. in business, they might.
I think in some big companies they do, yeah.
In which case it would become an issue for me, but it's not. So someone who says, no, I can't imagine retiring, but I'm also not a workaholic. That's an interesting answer because they love work and it's an ennobling thing to them, but they don't, but as I say, nobody wants to die at their desk. That's for sure.
Yeah. That's a great question. All right. Well, now I'm gearing up for the next interview. So thank you so much for joining us on the show, Richard. This was a really great conversation. Charu and I had so much fun. And I feel like we got a behind the scenes into what our professors were thinking when they our recognition letters. So it was, and it wasn't too long ago as well. So yeah, thank you so much.
It was kind of long ago. Like, let's not lie.
It was long ago. If anyone wants to see more of what I'm doing, I just have a personal website that goes to all my stuff at Richard. Yeah. It's just richardsalzman.com, S-A-L-S-M-A, and it's kind of like a hub where you go to that, and then you can go to all the four or five different things I'm doing, all the things I've published, all the places I'm speaking. You can get.
Yeah, thank you, Richard.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you
so much for your time.
Thank you all. Continued success with the program.
Thanks.
Thank you.